Welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, we're broadcasting a recording from one of the panels at our recent Defense Procurement in the 43rd Parliament Conference, which took place November 20th, 2019. This is a recording of the State of the Union panel that kicked off our conference, moderated by myself and featuring Claude Rochette, Michael Vandergrift, and Major General Ercole Gosselin.
So like I said, we're going to start off with a bit of a conversation about where things are today. These folks don't know who the new ministers are, at least they wouldn't tell me earlier. So what we're trying to do is kind of ground everybody in where, as of November 20th, where procurement is, where the implementation of Strong, Secure, Engage and all those procurement projects is. And with that, I will have Claude, you start us off by giving your sense from National Defense where that implementation sits as of November 20th, 2019.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Good morning, everybody. It's always a pleasure to come here and have a chance to share and let you know like where we are with our new defense policy. First, Dave, I want to thank you for the invitation, but also to organize such a conference, because like I said, it's always good. More and more we try to be transparent, especially with industry, so this is a good forum that we can exchange ideas and keep you informed. So talking about the defense policy and where we are now. I would say, like in my books, like I've been, as many people probably know here, I've been the CFO for 4 years, and starting last January, I was the Associate Deputy Minister. So I've been very involved in implementing the new defense policy. When I look at what we tried to do in 2016 with the new policy, and I look at where we are, I think that we are succeeding. Is it perfect? I would say no, it's not perfect. I think that the deputy mentioned that, I mentioned that many times too. I mean, looking at the plan for 20 years, it's not easy to plan. Sometimes I cannot plan my week ahead. So, when you look at what is coming up and the delay that can occur, I mean, sometimes we cannot plan for that. But when you look at that and where we have delivered so far, where we are, and I'm going to use some statistics, I think that we are doing very well. I'm very pleased to it. We have more work to do, and my colleagues will be talking about that. I will mention a few things that we are doing to try to get even better and to spend on time and to advance the projects. But at the end, when you look at the world today and you look at where we were way back in 2016, I would argue that even the threat is not the same today. So, and that's what we try to do when we develop the defense policy, is to get that flexibility so that the chief force development, the chief program, they can look at the threat and adjust as needed. So looking at that way, I mean, I think that we are doing pretty well. Just to give you a bit of some statistic, being an accountant, I need to throw some numbers in the equation. But just last year, we had 12,000 contracts, and we spent $6 billion. So, I mean, when you look at that, I mean, that's quite amazing. And most of these contracts, they were delivered on time and on budget. Of course, like many of them, they are small contracts, $1 million here and $2 million. It's just D&D can talk about big contracts and the billions. But when you look at that, is really like we are doing well. We hear a lot about like we are not delivering or we have delays, but I would argue that most of the time is when you look at large project that they are long-term, like 5-10 years in the procurement process. And at the beginning, we have some delays. And often when I look at that, sometimes we have to adjust for the threats. Sometimes we adjust because we want to change the technology. So there are all kind of reasons. But for us, it's more like what will happen on these large projects also. Are we going to deliver on time at the end when we expect to have that capability available for us? So just some other statistic. Looking at the expenditures, we talk quite often about the capital expenditures, especially in SSE. But if I look like capital expenditures, but also the Vote 1 operating for sustainment projects, like in 2016, we spent $4.9 billion. Last 2 years ago, 2017, 5.9. Last year, $6.1 billion. So as you can see, like we keep like increasing our expenditures. And we are just working on this fiscal year, and I can assure you that it's going to be, we are going to spend again because we are looking at the projection to close the fiscal year, and it will be tight. We are going to spend our budget. Of the projects, as you know, in SSE, we had 333 capital projects. 238 projects are in the closeout or implementation. So when I say implementation is we have a request for proposal already out, or we are working and going with request for information with industry, or we are working with our colleagues at PSPC to get the request for proposal ready to go out. So 238, so this is like 70%, and we are in year three of the policy. So we still have 17 years to go. So it's I think that we are doing pretty well when you look at it that way. Of the 238 projects, in fact, 105 now, they have been closed or they are in the process of closing out. So that's again, like compared to last year, we had 86. So we see an increase again there, like we see progress like all the time. And this does not happen just because like the process. I mean, we have been working very hard and we have been pushing, looking at our processes. We had consultants coming, helping us, looking at our processes. We talked to our Five Eyes partners to see like what are the best lessons and all that to try to be able to do better. I would say that probably the key change that we have done that has helped is to change the governance. And by doing that, we have been able to increase the oversight. So now we have an earlier oversight, which is great. So if there is a problem, we can highlight that right at the beginning and look for solutions. We get greater trust with the central agencies. So when we go to Treasury Board with our submissions, they know that we have a good process and we do our own review first before going there. And in fact, it has been demonstrated when they have approved to increase our procurement authority from $1 million to $5 million. Just that increase now will have 80% of our contracts will be done in-house in lieu of going out. So PSPC will be able to really concentrate their efforts into the large capital projects that we need the expertise in, and it takes time. And the results also, we spend more time at reducing delays, and if you look, we show, in fact, we have statistics also with our submissions, ministerial and Treasury Board submissions, and we see more and more of an increase every year. We exceed the cap in the number of submissions that we have done. So we are doing extremely well. I know that you gave us only 5 minutes. I will stop there, but I have plenty of examples of other processes that we have changed, and if people are interested, I can address that later.
Okay, hold those thoughts. Michael, your colleagues at National Defense have been beavering away, moving stuff through the early parts of the process. Can you speak to some of the procurement activity that you've been doing to translate all of that into engagements with industry?
Perfect. And thanks for moderating this. Thanks for the invitation, and thanks for organizing, bringing this community together. I think it's become pretty much an annual tradition now.
Part of the fall cycle.
So maybe I could just give you a quick update on some of the many procurements that are underway to help advance the Strong, Secure, Engage program. But I'd like to spend some particular time, as you noted in your question, around ways we're trying to test and innovate to help advance the program. Last year, since we met in this room, it's been a very busy time. Significant progress on a number of major capital projects will be familiar to most of you in the room. The future fighter procurement now underway with the RFP issued after extensive supplier engagement. We entered into contract with General Dynamics Land Systems to procure 360 armored combat support vehicles, advancing an important strong, secure, engaged commitment. On the shipbuilding side, there have been a number of programmatic decisions on both coasts. The government selected, as we all know, Lockheed Martin Canada for the design of 15 new surface combatants to be built at Irving Shipyards in Halifax, resequencing decisions on the West Coast. In addition, the Government of Canada made some significant announcements about the future of the National Shipbuilding Strategy through investments in the Coast Guard, which will have significant impacts on our future procurement activity. This includes constructing 16 multipurpose vessels at Vancouver Shipyards in Vancouver and two additional AOPS vessels configured for the Coast Guard at Irving. We're also launching a process to select a third shipyard under the National Shipbuilding Strategy to build six program icebreakers for the Coast Guard. And then most importantly, we're starting to see vessels launched on both coasts, which is great news in making the program more of a reality. There's other number of major procurements that are underway that are going to continue to advance in the coming months. Remotely piloted aircraft system, future aircrew training, the Victoria-class submarine in-service support contract, logistics vehicle modernization. All of these are really significant, large procurements. All of them are through the invitation to qualify stage. We're now into developing the RFP for these. So there's lots of procurements underway, but what I'd like to do is focus a bit on how we can improve and what we're trying to do to improve the way we undertake procurements. And we know there's a lot of room for improvement here, and I think there's a real opportunity for rich dialogue with suppliers, with academics, with others in the community about how we can continue to be try to be more efficient, more agile, and produce procurement results for the Canadian Armed Forces. Just a couple examples, if I could, Dave, just quickly. One last year at this venue, there was some talk about a pilot project we are launching with Treasury Board Secretariat and National Defence to try to streamline the way we take contracts to Treasury Board for approval, just to try to explain what is quite a bureaucratic process. Our authorities for contracts, the Minister of Public Services and Procurement Canada's authorities for to enter into contracts are dollar-based, whereas on projects, they're risk-based. So in the world of defense, as you all know, it's pretty easy to exceed dollar-based limits on contracts just by the nature of the business, but they may not be actually inherently that risky. So we entered into this pilot project with Treasury Board Secretariat to introduce a risk valuation of these procurements so that those lower-risk procurements, still larger value, but lower risk overall, can be approved without having to spend the time and energy needing to go to Treasury Board first. So we've been tracking progress since this launched in the beginning of 2019. And between December and June, we've had 9 contracts worth almost $2.5 billion that otherwise would have had to go to Treasury Board first. PSPC was able to enter them into them directly. This saves time and energy that would be spent on going to the board and allows that time and energy to be expended on other capital projects, again, trying to use our resources as efficiently as possible. Another change we're seeing more and more in procurements is the use of cure periods, whereas before, suppliers might have been disqualified immediately if they did not meet a mandatory requirement. There's now opportunities for bidders to receive feedback for bidders then to adjust their submission to address the non-compliance. And this has the benefit of avoiding failed procurements and also increasing competition. Just as a final point, just quickly, Dave, I think it's also important that we look at our contract requirements, work with our partners to try to advance more outcomes-based procurements, trying to move where we can away from kind of the traditional model of very heavy prescriptive requirements with the kind of traditional time and material types of basis of payments, and look at some more innovative models and how we can unlock innovation in the supplier community to help solve problems. We see that in some smaller scales through the IDEAS program, for example. The fighter jets RFP actually had significant outcomes-based elements in it. Through the sustainment initiative on the in-service support side, we're really committed to advancing this to try to create contracts and relationship structures with suppliers where there's where they're very incentive-based, where there's win-win scenarios based on performance rather than kind of a more traditional contract structure. So I think there's lots of room for conversation with suppliers of the Canadian defense sector on how we can advance improvements in the procurement system, where we can try and innovate and test to see how it works, to how we can advance the program. And we do this also, you know, we have regular conversations with international allies, with Australia, with the UK, US, on these types of topics as well. Maybe I'll leave that there, and we can talk more in the conversation.
Great. General, the Chief of Program in the VCDS's organization kind of meshes the money and the procurements at National Defense to make the Defense Services Program. Can you talk a little bit about how that's evolved in the last couple of years since that Strong, Secure, Engage was published?
Well, thank you very much, David, and good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure for me to represent this morning Lieutenant General Jean-Marc Lancier, the Vice Chief of Defense Staff for today's conference. I've been the Chief Program since July 2018. So, as many here will know, the Vice Chief is responsible for the planning and management of capital projects and programs in D&D. From a Canadian Armed Forces perspective, we are happy with the progress that is being made to implement the defense policy. This said, we are a learning organization, working with all the stakeholders to improve delivery of our defense services program. As the associate DM mentioned in his opening remarks, the CC implementation is working. And capital projects are moving forward. This is evidence as D&D has transitioned 186 SSC projects through significant life cycle gates since launch in 2017. Some example of major projects that have reached final operating capabilities in that time frame. We talk about the Royal Canadian Navy Halifax class modernization, Canadian Army tactical armored patrol vehicle, and the Royal Canadian Air Force medium to heavy lift helicopter. Success for these
was in large part achieved due to years of partnership between industry, D&D, CAF, and of course other government department partners. Has a new capability eventually become introduced and subsequent and in subsequent investment plans, the opportunity for industry will continue to be reflected in the defense capability blueprint. I will now speak to some of the process improvement and new tools we use in D&D. So I was saying that I'm going to unpack a bit some of the things we're doing here in the department. And so we have developed and are now fully leveraging the Capital Investment Program Plan Review. We call that the CIPR tool. This is a scientific-based analytic tool within which all capital equipment projects are assessed against policy, joint capability, and sponsor priority. This methodology ensures that D&D CAF advances the right capabilities for our needs in a portfolio, in a balanced portfolio about cost, scope, and schedule. The output enables senior leadership to make evidence-based investment and trade-off decisions. We have developed and implemented a new Defense Services Program portal. This internal online site features four significant tools: the redesigned capability investment database, the renewed project approval directive, executive-level analytics support through new and enhanced decision support tracking tools, and redesigned courses aimed at workforce professionalization. Looking first at improvement over the capability investment database, we have fully migrated essential data from older legacy databases to our DREAMIST system of record, which is based on the SEP-based project system. This is enabling business transformation through enhanced data management and greater agility in how we use our data within the newly designed analytic tools. This has empowered multiple governance bodies to access and leverage project and program data consistently for decision support purposes and to quickly identify challenges within our capital program. We have redesigned the project approval directive, PAD. The PAD is aligned with the new Treasury Board policy and subdirective launched only 6 months ago. It provides interactive guides and templates to assist project staff through all phases of a project's life cycle. The PAD now has four streamlined process paths instead of a previous one process fit all approach. The new streamlined process, reduction and standardization of project documentation, and accelerated governance scheduling is expected to result in saving of time and prevention of project schedule slippage within the project approval process. We have modernized executive-level analytics. We have implemented business intelligence and tracking tools that empower senior governance decision-making. This enables greater insight into previously ungoverned space, the transition between process and periods between project approval phases. We now have full visibility to see how we're doing about it. This provides senior leadership with an improved ability to get out ahead of challenges and direct actions for a more evidence-based position. Finally, we have redesigned a suite of classroom and online courses where aimed at improving workforce professionalization. The project approval course and the defense resource management course have both been relaunched, reflecting the new PAD, new and improved governance, and an in-depth understanding of key tools such as CIPR. The classroom serials also have been open to provide number of seats to professionals from key government departments who support Defense Capital Program. The online training has enabled us to widen the training audience across the defense, including those outside the National Capital Region. So with our key partners, TBS, PSPC, ICID, and the defense industry, along with the benefit of the contribution from the academia, we are delivering capability for the CAF required today and in the future to the best serve Canada and the Canadian. I will hand my remarks now and looking forward to Q&A. Thank you very much.
So, Claude, what I was hearing the general talk about was a number of different changes to process, which are presumably going to have a positive impact on some of the schedules for the projects. So recognizing that that's all tied into the way that the money and the capital investment plan is laid out over time, said we still got 17 years left, but as all of those changes go through and as procurements move forward, what happens to the plan that was published in Strong, Secure, Engage, and how would that evolve over time, and how would those in the audience that are looking at this from outside of government be able to see how that's all evolving?
Thanks for your question. Yeah, you're right, and in fact, we have already, we initiated just over a year ago a review of the investment plan, a review of our capital investment fund, working with our partners in finance and treasury board, and basically looking at where we are, the project that's been delayed. One thing you have to keep in mind is when we have developed in 2016, the new defense policy, it was a small group, and we were looking into it with and keeping that very close. So now that we have started 3 years later, the plan is out. We are fully transparent. We have that published, in fact. So we are working, especially with our implementers, like in infrastructure, the folks in information technology, ADM MAT, of course, and talking with them and say, okay, this is where we are. These are the delays we have seen so far. So where do you think really like industry will be able to, like we will be ready to go with a request for proposal and where industry will be able to deliver. So we are doing that review right now. We are almost completing that. When this will be done, we are going to work with finance to realign our funding that we need. And the investment plan, then the blueprint is going to be amended so that we keep everybody informed where we are. One thing that we have to, and I still trying to figure out, and I've been talking to people, including you, is when we did the new defense policy. Before that, we had basically a capital envelope, and we had some money for incremental costs in case that we have different cost increase. And it was mainly like in the reserve set aside. When we did the new policy, because we wanted to see the full costs for each project, we basically moved all the contingencies in these projects. The problem that we are facing now and we have seen over the past 3 years is that people will look at, okay, you said you would be spending $6.1 billion in that year in capital money, and you have spent only $5 billion or $4.8 or whatever the number is, and you have a gap. So, and it's difficult to go and explain to people, yes, but part of that gap that we have not asked for the funding is money that was set aside just in case that there is any cost increase in that given year. That money is not lost, it's in the fiscal framework, it's part of our capital investment fund, which is great that we have, like that's probably the best model we could have for national defense. It works very well because the funding stays there, and we just reprofile the funding for when we expect that it will be needed. So all that stays within our $108 billion over 20 years, and we manage that. So what you will see when we have the next iteration of the public investment plan is you will see these changes, and we expect it to go and really highlight where we were, where we are now, and to show so it will be easy for industry to see that movement.
You're listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
Michael, to come back to you again, so your organization's on the end, or close to the end of that process, or at least the back half of it, when all of that work ends up coming out to tender. You talked a little bit about some of the contracting streamline that Minister Qualtrough mentioned last year. So if this is all going to come to fruition, there's going to be more work coming your department's way. Do you see that right now that there's other opportunities for additional risk-based approaches? And what do you think could be the tangible impact of that for folks in the room in terms of time savings or the amount of work that you can do concurrently or faster? What are the opportunities in that space?
Yeah, thanks. It's a continual issue for us in terms of trying to figure out where we can best allocate resources according to risk of the project, working with industry moving through. So I think you'll see it through a lot of industry engagement around the particular procurements, and then working through that industry engagement where we can identify ways to streamline the process, where we could use different types of evaluation of proposals, et cetera. So I think the pilot project I spoke about on the contracts is an interesting example of that. We're still assessing its full impact, but it's pretty promising, at least in the first 6 months, in terms of how we can, you know, really take a hard look and kind of look at our rule set and look where there might be some barriers in our rule set, right, in terms of the approval processes and where does it make sense to spend time and energy. And in this case, I think it was felt that this was not... you know, there was better ways to do this and better places to put our time in terms of time for ministers and Treasury Board to look at particular proposals, time for us to make the submissions to them, to focus that much more on the higher risk ones and be able to move on contracts that are lower risk more quickly. So industry should be seeing that hopefully in contracts that are lower risk moving through more quickly. But I think it really isn't that industry dialogue, Dave, that we really want to, at the front end of these procurements, to explore what is possible in terms of how we can move forward and move away from perhaps some of that more traditional approaches.
So, General, to follow up on the comments you were making about the different ways you're looking at streamlining parts of process. So, what are you going to do to communicate that across your stakeholders in government to try and get people situated with the different routes that different projects potentially are going to be on based on those efforts? And then how can, to continue with the idea about industry engagement, how can folks outside of government get a sense of where you're making these changes and where to look for potential shifts in approach, potential streamlining, and potential differences in terms of how they would be on the other end of these things when they move through your internal systems?
What I'm keen to make sure is that from a chief program perspective is that the tools that we're building so that the flow of project, capital project move is that we make sure that we get the approval at the right time so that from the industry perspective, we are true to the investment plan and the capability-based blueprint so that there is alignment between the project moving forward, money being available, and industry being able to do its part. So the tool is to make sure that that flow goes well, and the tools are very much about making sure that in-house we are proceeding at the right tempo, the right speed, so that we're true to what we see that these two documents are doing. So that's for the first comment. Could you repeat the first question, please?
So you're looking at potentially having different routes for different types of projects?
Right.
So based on the different characteristics. So if you're someone that's sitting in industry and you're looking at project A, how would they get a sense of where the path is going to be and whether or not they're going to see a direct impact on the particular pursuit that they're looking at? Or how can folks outside of government from the bleachers like myself look at what you're doing and get a sense of which projects are going to potentially go in sort of the quicker routes or some of the routes where you're going to have to go through the full set of governance that they have in the past?
Okay. The different path goes with the level of complexity and the amount of each of the project. What is really important is that this is in-house. So it's very much about how we're making sure that the SSC project are moving at the right rhythm. So this is transparent for the industry, which takes its cue from the investment plan and the capability blueprint tools. But inside, we want to make sure that if we can accelerate this project quicker, we can talk about them when it's time indeed to proceed forward. The EDM MAT's work is to reach out when the level of maturity of a project is ready to move forward, and then through Treasury Board, of course.
So in a minute, I'm going to turn things over and open up the opportunity for folks to either go to a mic, or if you can, quickly text me, email me, or send me a direct message on Twitter if you don't want to ask something directly. Before going to do that, a last question to the three of you. What aspect of implementing your part of the procurements in Strong, Secure, Engaged do you think is going better than expected, and which is proving to be more challenging than you thought? Michael, you look most pensive. You can start.
We're last in the chain there, Dave. You
yeah.
Okay,
I can start. I think that certainly, like I was mentioning, the smaller projects that we have, many of them, we can move them very quickly. Like I said, we have a very good, we are closing many of them already. And it's because of what the general was talking about, like changing the internal process, the governance. So for example, we have gave to lower level, the capability board, for example, they can approve any projects $5 million. So we don't have to bring that up to the chief of the defense staff and the deputy minister. We have the project management board that is co-chaired by the CFO, myself, and the vice chief of the defense staff. We have up to $50 million. Then we have IRMC, which is the investment resource committee, that they are looking at 50, is chaired by the deputy minister. It's $50 million and above. So because we bring that hand, like we can make the decision, and with the new authority we have at $5 million for procurement, we can do it in-house and very quickly. So that works extremely well. I think that another part that is working well is the new program that we brought in under the policy, and I'm thinking more about innovation. So ideas and minds are very good. In fact, we get to a point where our chief of science and technology, she's wondering how she will be able to manage that within the $85 million a year that we put aside, because it's working very well, and we go out and we engage industry and say, this is the problem, and tell us what you can. So I think we are very successful in that part too. Michael has been talking a bit about the engagement with industry. I think that more and more now we do RFIs. Like before going with a request for proposal, we go and we talk to industry to try to understand that. PatFin initiated that like a couple of years ago, and we are doing it more and more, and we intend to do it even more. It helps us that when we write the request for proposal, we have a better understanding of what we should be asking. And in fact, even the request of proposal now is we tried, and I mean, we still have to learn here, but we tried more and more to go and present what the requirements are without telling industry what the solution is, and to let industry to come back and to tell us. And attached to that is even when we receive the bids after that, we have what we call the cure period, where we have an engagement. So if you have one industry that put a bid and they are not successful, we sit with them, have a discussion, and to understand and explain why. And sometimes it's just a misunderstanding of what we're asking, and they have a chance to submit their bid again. And that has been very helpful to move the file very quickly. Probably in a place where we have the biggest challenge, I would argue, is that the long-term projects, $100 billion, and like where they are long-term, we still don't have the visibility. I remember when we started the new defense policy, and people were saying, okay, I want something that flies. It's okay, well, how do you want me to cost it, right? And so I always use the example when people say, well, your costing is not right. And I said, okay, well, I want to have a car and to buy a car next year. So tell me how much I will pay for it. And first reaction is, well, what kind of car and what you do? But some of these projects, this is where we are still in that positions where we still have the chief force development and chief program that they are looking at the threat and looking at what would be the best capability for them. And we are not there yet. So this is an area where we need to have like more consultation and trying to move that faster so that we can be on time.
Michael?
Just quickly, I think what's worked well has been that the connection between the planning into the procurements into, like we look and say, that, man, there's a lot going on and a lot that the teams have been able to advance over the last year. So I think that's gone really quite well in terms of kind of connecting from the policy through to just a lot of major projects happening. Things that are challenging, I mean, some of these projects are just incredibly complicated and complex. Each one of them has a life of their own, and that requires a lot of kind of constant management attention, risk management, et cetera. So that probably not unexpected, but is a challenge. The other I would say is for us is we have a really strong foundation of people to build on in our team in terms of procurement experts, really great people. Challenge trying to make sure that we continue to have the capacity to deliver this, that we're kind of recruiting, retaining, and training our people to deliver on the program.
In my case, I would say twofold. Unity of purpose. I'm attending a lot of interdepartmental meeting in a weekly fashion, and it's impressive to see the level of communication between all the departments to move the program forward, and how people genuinely work through the issue to make sure that we meet what we say that we're going to deliver as part of the investment plan. This is truly something that I didn't know before I became the chief of program, and I'm really, really impressed to see how the partners really in very, very complex issue, working together and leveraging each one expertise so that the program gets executed. This is something that I find personally working extremely well. Internally, I think the agility that we have now that we've built the tools to really see ungoverned space, truly see the program, to see move forward, and the ability to have the leadership to governance to say, okay, this is installing why I want to hear about that project, find the solution among all the stakeholders, and then move on, is working extremely well. We don't have files that are stalling in the department from outside from our side of the house, because we have built the tools and we have the governance that is agile enough now to make sure to move forward. So internally and externally, I see nothing but improvement from my perspective.
So the microphones are still a little lonely, but my phone is lighting up. So I'm going to take a question from here. I think all three of you touched on this a bit. Michael, I think maybe most explicitly. So if you look right now, I think compared to other time periods, there's more big projects that have a lot of complexity that are, you know, kind of over the billion-dollar threshold that are all sort of moving ahead more or less at the same time. So recognizing that those particular types of projects tend to take additional watering and feeding relative to other ones, how do you, what are you trying to do to manage just that concurrency aspect of just the big ones? And I guess for General Gosselin in the end, how do you account for the fact that if you've got some of these real big complicated projects, their time and their route forward, they're inevitably going to take more time. They're probably going to get more scrutiny by the incoming government. So how do you try and balance that concurrency, recognizing that, as you said, Claude, you were originally starting doing several hundred projects all at once, but some of them are going to, and there's a lot of them more happening at the same time than there has been in the past. How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah. It's a really good question. I'd say a couple things. One is that question of where we allocated resources. So that having DND's authority going to $5 million, for example, allows PSPC to focus much more on the large capital projects. We're putting our time and our attention on our authorities, et cetera. That's a big part of it. The second I'd say is governance is really key. And the governance between departments, I think, is working quite well in managing these large projects, keeping on top of them, understanding where they are, trying to execute decisions when they need to be made. So that's really important. The governance exists at different levels between all of us, all the partners. And that time and attention on those key, and then you're right to note that there are a number of really key, difficult ones all going at the same time. It's really that time and intention through governance that's really important in deciding where we're going to focus our time and energy.
On the D&D point of view, I think that the fact that now we have the new accountability and we have authority for $5 million, we are investing more in staff, so we are hiring more procurement officers. We have started a program where we are training our staff to become like professional procurement officers. So that's going very well, and we see progress already. So that is helping a lot. I would say also the fact that now giving authority at lower level, was talking earlier, and the decisions are being made faster, we can spare time. Like before, we were spending our wheels, sometimes on details, forever. And it was dragging, and we kept asking more and more information from the staff. So they were not doing other work. They were like basically working on a specific project. So now we are starting to see also that change, not only just internally, but even working with our colleagues in finance and treasury board, where the time that we need to do an analysis of the submissions, it's shorter and we can move it faster. So then we can use that staff to do more work.
Over here.
Thanks. Andrew Kendrick from Vard Marine. I'd like to thank all the panelists for giving us some really interesting insights into the process. My specific question is for Mr. Vandergrift. You mentioned your pilot project for using a risk-based approach to determining project governance or project process. Is that taking into account the industry perception of risk, or is this entirely within the government's perception of risk? The reason I ask is that these days we are always required for large procurements to submit some form of risk management plan. Often in RFIs, we're asked for this. Can you convince us that this is actually being taken into account in the approaches that the government is taking?
It's an assessment amongst officials on it, but it's informed by discussions with industry and about the project itself, because the contract has advanced quite far by the time we're doing this, right, at the point of basically contract award. So there has been a lot of discussion with industry through this process. So we have a lot of knowledge about what kind of the context around the contract, we're looking at things like legal risk, implementation risk, and other things. But that's one of the questions we'll be evaluating the pilot project to see if it is achieving its intended results.
Yeah, I think we would certainly encourage that, because we all have most of us have fairly sophisticated risk assessment tools when we go into a procurement.
Yeah.
And that may be insights that the government doesn't necessarily have in-house.
But as I'd emphasize, it's towards the end of the procurement process where this is taking place, it's at the time of contract award, essentially.
Okay, so at this mic on my left, and then I'll get your question and then Alan's right afterwards.
Sure. Mine is just maybe a follow-up to the last question, Andy Cook from CAE. I'm wondering if at the completion of the pilot project, there will be an opportunity. What I heard was that PSPC is looking at risk-based approaches to speed projects through. And I heard CPROG saying that in D&D we're trying to streamline, or D&D is trying to streamline based more on dollar values. I understand it's a pilot project at this time, but will there be an opportunity, could we infer that there will be a logical opportunity for D&D to align with PSPC if the results of the pilot project are positive?
And before you, I'll take Alan's question.
Well, this may be slightly related, but given the government's commitment to create something called Defense Procurement Canada, if it in fact is a consolidation of the resources in PSPC and D&D, what's your reaction to that?
Feel free to not answer that one if that's going to put you in hot water.
That one I'm not in a position to answer. Or do so.
We're going to be talking about that a lot at the end of the day, but it'd be interesting to get your perspective.
That one I'm not going to... Others.
So fulsome answer on the first question then.
Well,
I mean, what really isn't, I mean, it's something definitely we'd want to look at, but what's actually intended to try to align is with project authorities that our Department of National Defense as the project holder has. Those are actually risk-based. So trying to align contract authorities with project authorities so that we higher risk projects are all going to the board and lower risk projects or not would be the ideal. But yeah, we're in early days here, and we'll see how this goes.
Good morning. Kelly Williams from Mission Systems Canada. I had the privilege last week to attend the NATO Industrial Forum in Washington, and it was followed by a focused discussion in the NATO Industrial Advisory Group that was being informed by SACTI. And what was quite startling, I think, for everybody was a panel that was comprised of the leading entrepreneurial and startup companies in IT in the United States. And the recognition that we've reached a point where technology is actually driving capabilities faster than governments able to understand them. Mm-hmm. And the recognition inside Allied Command Transformation that services have become a capability unto itself. Huh. And what Allied Command Transformation is doing is they're looking to fundamentally change acquisition of services, primarily in coding and software, from an analytics perspective to pull in new capabilities. And they're looking for a 90-day to a 6-month turnaround with no RFI, no RFP, no statement of requirement, to reposition industry to be able to educate governments as to what's really happening in the technology base in the commercial world. So my question for the panel is, what changes are you guys preparing for or positioning to fundamentally overhaul contracting, recognizing that you're going to need in the future a whole new relationship with industry that's based far more transparency, openness, and trust, that's going to basically result in the fact that from an HR perspective, all the people in your capacities are not prepared for this impending change. So how are you getting ready for the future?
Thanks for bringing that observation. That's very interesting from the conference that you attended. I think actually there's a panel this afternoon on agile procurement in the IT space, and there'll be some folks here to talk about that. And we are starting to definitely test in the IT space more agile procurement, short bursts of development, kind of rapid deployment testing, next rapid deployment testing. Because of that very point, that particularly in the IT space, the idea of a 10,000 requirements for the next 20 years may not work so well anymore, given the rapid pace of change and development in that industry. So I think there's some time this afternoon to talk about the kind of experiments with more agile procurement models, particularly in IT. And I think the rich point to raise there for them to get their observations on it. But we're starting to roll try to test with some of those methodologies in information technology procurements. We can draw lessons from that for broader use.
In fact, your question is very much about obsolescence, not only in IT, but in all aspects of the capability we need to support the Canadian Armed Forces. And this is something that we started to think about. How do we manage obsolescence as more and more cycle when capability needs to evolve and change is accelerating as the world and technology is evolving. So it's a very contemporary question that you're asking. It is something that we're thinking about, not now, but what does it mean for the future, not only for IT, but for the entire range of capability that we will need in the Canadian Armed Forces.
Okay, so in the remaining time, I'm going to go, we got two more that came in, I'm going to try and lump together. One is about how the government across the different departments is communicating externally about where the procurements are, how they're moving, the changes that you're making, and what you're looking to do in that respect. And the second one is, so recognizing that you're trying to make a number of different significant changes to approaches on procurements, cure periods, that type of thing. How are you balancing that off with the system that's designed to resist change at all cost, to be pejorative? And then how do you also try and manage the balance between trying new things and then making all of the processes defendable for all the ways that you need to do that with a system that's kind of got an inherent built-in mechanism to try and dissuade you from doing that? So how do you balance the innovation on approach with the risk of doing something new and then having to live with having done something new?
Maybe if I can start, I was mentioning about the two programs we have, Minds and Ideas. I think this is a good example where we are learning a lot from that, where really we just go out and ask industry to come back and tell us what would be the best for us, and we are learning a lot from that. The challenge will be, like you said, is how can we apply that after that for all the other projects and larger projects than just $1 million projects. I would argue that probably especially like is the tolerance to risk, and more now we see with right, the delegation of authorities, we see with the trying to look at projects and be more open, transparent, share information. We are learning slowly to be more transparent. It comes back to the discussion that or the question we just had earlier, which. Very interesting, like on IT is a good example where we realize more and more now, especially with the large platform like being ships or planes, and that the technology there is a key driver and we have to learn from there. So more and more we have no choice. We have to engage more with industry. So I think that we are already there. Like at least our mind is set to that. Now is to develop the proper process to see how we are going to work with our colleagues like from PSPC and the department so that we can reach out more and more.
It's a good question. I mean, we obviously have to innovate and test within a legal framework, within a regulatory framework. We get lots of legal advice when we undertake these measures, but we try to do it consciously, right? You try to assess what the risk is, how you can. There's actually a lot you can do with an existing policy and existing regulatory framework if you think about things a little bit differently. So, but we are doing it within an overall context. But it is trying to be deliberate about it and trying to I guess speak more openly about it. It's a conversation we have internally. It's a conversation like I said we were having with suppliers and academia. We want to have more of that about what we're learning from these and how we can advance further. So I think it's really kind of an open conversation around these. And I'll say honestly, I've been kind of pleasantly surprised how much interest and willingness there is internally to try these things. And the ideas are coming from our teams in terms of how to do things differently. We want to keep encouraging.
I want to ask everybody to join me in thanking a panel. For folks in government coming on a day where they've got lots on their plate for the remaining of the day.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Today we were listening to our State of the Union on Defense Procurement panel from our Defense Procurement and the 43rd Parliament Conference, featuring myself as a moderator, Claude Rochette, Michael Vandergrift, and Major General Ercole Gosselin. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating wherever you're listening to your podcast, as it helps to promote it and have it grow. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go out to our producer Jay Rankin and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.